You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the Midside, where our code of conduct is more sacred to us than the Konami code was to 90s preteen boys. I'm your host, Daniel T. Richards. That's right, comrades, there was a coup down in Justintown, and yours truly is taking over the Ministry of Propaganda, truth, this week. Resistance is futile, but encouraged. Your regularly scheduled host will return next week, or when we finally get an interview with Zack Snyder, praise be his name, whichever comes first. If you're having JML withdrawals, just wait 20 minutes for his pre-recorded section, stalker. Jeez, get off me. Or you can visit themidside.com to get his take on Superman versus naturalist zombies, and then head over to howtozombie.com, that's howtozombie.com, to see his take on zombies of a completely different kind. But until next week, you're stuck with my sultry tenor voice and the voices of the fine fellows joining me in this great revolution. Via Skype from the House of Mouse, Generalissimo Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm doing well. This glorious baritone voice is just ready to do my part.
Excellent. It's going to need to break up the monotony of my incredibly high-pitched womany voice. Nothing, happening in your life, nothing special other than you've been promoted to Generalissimo.
Generalissimo! I am excited.
Yeah, that wasn't racist at all either, by the way.
No. I'm Puerto Rican, I can say it. Okay. Generalissimo!
Also joining us today, via Skype, a very special guest from the lengths of sand, California, Commissar William Green. How are you, William?
Doing great. Surviving the flood. We're building an ark out front right now. We've had a whole 2 inches of rain in the last 2 days, which I think for the part of California I'm in, that's exactly how much rain we had last year total. So we're everyone's there's panic in the streets.
I bet over there in California. I used to live in LA for a while, and when it rained, it was just like mass pandemonium and panic. Especially among drivers.
Amateur.
Who just had no idea how to deal with that or curves in the road or pretty much anything.
Yeah, it's been an interesting couple days trying to get to work, but I survived so far, and I think the rain's supposed to let up tomorrow, so we might make it.
Let's talk about some other people who don't know how to act. It's time for the news with me. We want to talk a little bit about conduct this week, specifically how we should act with other people and then also with ourselves. Nothing could be more close to this topic this week than the topic of race and Ferguson and this nonsense. Thought Catalog, a website I don't read very often, but when I do, I get pissed off, has an article called How to Be White in America and What to Do About Ferguson, where author Jamie Verone, who apparently is white, gives us some tips about how we, racist white people, can start being better whites in this post-Ferguson America. The first tip is, of course, to stop making assumptions about what it's like to be black or a minority in America. He says, quote, just stop. We don't know what it's like. We can't begin to understand the systemic oppression, institutionalized racism, police brutality, for-profit imprisoning, and ingrained fear of black faces that is the day-to-day reality for black people. We are white. We know only our experience. Doesn't that automatically contradict this whole thing about stop making assumptions and try to get outside yourself?
Yeah, I think, you know, knowledge is just not possible. I mean, if you can't directly experience it, how could you know? I mean, you just can't know anything unless you've actually experienced it.
Yeah,
that's what I'm hearing here. I don't know what it's like to be a straight man because I've never been a straight man, so I can't understand your perspective, Daniel. We have a rift between us, and it shall never be gulfed by knowledge. It just can't happen.
I know, it's like me and like the Walking Dead fan. I am not a Walking Dead fan. I don't know. There's a gulf between us, Daniel and Justin, that will never be healed.
That's mostly a country. I guess there's the Gulf of Mexico, but it's mostly land that's between us. But this entire thing about you don't know what it's like because you're white. And it goes on. This is probably my favorite part. He talks about privilege, and he says, maybe you don't think you have this privilege, but the fact that you don't see your privilege is evidence that you are privileged. So what happens then if you see your privilege? Does that mean then you're not privileged?
Oh, wow.
I think it's turtles all the way down. I think you just, you know, everyone has privilege and doesn't have privilege at the same time in the same respect. It's just, you know, you just got to embrace the contradiction, man.
It's Schrodinger's privilege.
Yeah.
You might have it in my either way. It's perfect.
Put that on a t-shirt and sell it. So his next bit of advice for how to be white in America is to educate yourself. Quote, don't speak from your own experience.
Wait. But we just said that if you can't experience it, you can't. So am I supposed to put blackface on and go out and
oh my God.
Pop?
Absolutely.
$20 to do that.
Okay.
Absolutely do not put blackface on. That would be the opposite, I think, of what they're trying to accomplish in this article.
Well, is there some sort of reverse Michael Jackson operation I can undergo so that I can experience this and educate myself?
Dude, you could tan yourself like that woman. You know, Tan Lady. What's her name?
Oh, no.
Tan Lady. Oh, her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that famous one that's like all...
So hideously. No. No, it was some lady that spent a little bit too much time, I think like hours every day in the tanning booth, and her skin was just like permanently... Well, I don't know what color you would call it, but it was more than tan.
It's like a burgundy. Fine burgundy.
She aged poorly, or she's drinkable now? Okay. The next bit of advice the author gives us is stop allowing your guilt or defensiveness to cloud your judgment about which side you are on. So, despite the fact that we are white people who can't get outside of our own race, who should educate ourselves about our own race, we should not allow that and the guilt caused by the subsequent complete confusion to stop us from picking a side, as long as it's not the white side.
I love that he says you should be on the side of justice. Mm-hmm. Okay, exactly how, I mean, he needs to explain his concept of justice, because what he's describing is not any kind of rational understanding of what the concept and the virtue of justice is.
So let's dig into that a little bit, because frankly the rest of this article makes me want to projectile vomit. So the concept of justice here they're working on, it's usually called social justice, right? The idea that that groups of people need justice. But what the heck does that even mean?
I don't know. You know, it's hard because if you try to look at individual, you know, persons of minority, like whatever minority they are, and you try to point out, you know, look, here's some folks that are doing well off, and, you know, there's people that aren't being oppressed, it won't matter because there are these groups identified by these, you know, out of context, like whatever physical characteristics or cultural characteristics that... Look, they're being held down by the man, and that's what people really want to focus on. These kinds of folks really want to focus on that for their political agenda.
Isn't this also sort of handicapping people at the very beginning to tell them for their entire lives, you are handicapped, you are being held down by the man, you can't help it, what situation you're in?
Yeah,
in fact, don't even try.
It's a form of original sin in a way. That's kind of what it is. They're getting you from a very your most basic philosophical premise from when you're young, inculcating kids when they're in school, teaching about these kinds of things about white privilege and racial tensions and stuff like that. I mean, it's really that's kind of the secular version of original sin. You are white, and because of the trespasses of white people whom you're probably not even related to, from centuries ago, you should feel guilty.
Yeah, and Elliot, on top of that, that guilt and on the white person here, we're also doing a destruction to the black person who buys into this, right? We're saying, you know, any of the good stuff you happen that happens to you, it's just going to be ephemeral because we have a system that's in, you know, that's just minimizes and oppresses and threatens you systematically. So, you know, just enjoy what little you can now because, you know, everything that goes wrong in your life is just it's just because of the system, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, it's transient. Your achievements are transient, and if you and people who really achieve their Uncle Toms or their whatever other slurs people like to throw at them, whereas you know the little achievements that you have in your life, they're transient. Don't you know people are going to always try to take them away from you, so you've got to hold on to them. That's kind of the mentality that I think people are starting to buy into.
It's unfortunate. So let's skip a few of these points because they're terrible. But what he says, how to be a white in America, stop focusing on the riots is one of his points, which is a very interesting thing to say. His point, I think, overall, is that this is a few bad apples who are rioting. And in fact, it's partially caused by the system itself. They held the grand jury announcement at 9 p.m. Eastern because they knew there would be riots. And if they, he says, even he even hypothesizes, they knew if they announced it in the middle of the day, there would be peaceful protests. However, they announced it at night and then tear gassed protesters because now the story is about the rioting and arson, not the actual story at hand, which is terrible writing. But other than that, I think it's also a terrible point.
By the way, Jamie Varon is a female.
Oh. I can't even tell anymore with these names and the... Whatever. Put a picture up there. So what do you think about this point? Do you think they purposely held this at night because they knew it would incite riots? That seems like a... Like, that is a claim for which you have to have pretty substantial evidence.
I think you could just assert it. I mean, since after all, we can't tell any knowledge without experience, you know, and we just experienced it. So you just can just assert it because, I mean, there's no way to tell.
Check your privilege, William. And then the other thing is he goes on here to say, and it's an essay. He, I keep saying he. She goes on to point out, for instance, that there are a lot of racist comments being thrown around this, which... One, doesn't prove anything, as we learned a few weeks ago. There are about 100 commenters who generate hundreds of thousands of comments on the healthcare.gov Facebook page. So volume doesn't even matter. But it pulls out 4 screenshots from Facebook. And if you look on here, I think there are exactly 3 racist comments. Maybe 3.5, depending on your definition.
And I think I get more than that on my feed in a day.
Right, and there are about 10 on here that are not racist comments that he considers to be racist comments. So, first of all, if you're going to make a point and you're going to use visual evidence, use good visual evidence. Take 10 minutes to solidify your point. This reminds me of the catcalling video where 15 minutes of it is, "Hi, what are you up to? You look very nice today, ma'am."
The one guy that said, "God bless you."
Like, okay, make your point, but edit out the shit that doesn't make your point. You know, so his last, he has, oh my God, she.
You misogynist.
I'm not only racist, but I genuinely couldn't believe that a woman could write something so shitty. That's why I keep saying he, but I guess that makes me a misogynist. The last few points he makes are, get angry. All black men's lives matter. For instance, that's a thing that keeps getting thrown around here. Let's not talk about the white guy who was just murdered with hammers, which now we're pretty sure was a racially motivated crime. His life doesn't mean anything, just black men. Question yourself, he says, although we can't get outside of our privilege, and I'm pretty sure he's already said this. And then finally, be respectful and humble. So get angry and be respectful and humble. I don't know what this article wants me to do. How am I supposed to act as a white man in America? What am I supposed to take away from this?
I was looking for a checklist. There's no sort of procedure or checklist. I don't know what to do other than experience it. So I've experienced this article, and I don't know what to do.
I don't either.
Where's the call to action?
I'm so confused. They end with a quote by Desmond Tutu, which is, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor," which I'm pretty sure is a bastardization of an Ayn Rand quote.
I agree.
But, alas, if I'm going to have to choose some way to act, then I'm going to choose to act like Devante Hart. Devante Hart is a young black boy who decided to go out in protest by basically saying, holding up a sign that said, "Free Hugs." You may have seen him around the internet, because a picture of him tearfully hugging a police officer has gone viral. What do you guys think about this? Is this more the message that needs to be sent, as opposed to burn the motherfucker down?
My best friend is a cop, and I have lots of friends that are in law enforcement, and it's really hard to see some of the rhetoric that comes out about things like this. And you know, it's nice to see a picture like that where people are actually, you know, at least it looks like someone is actually thankful for the job that law enforcement does to try and keep the peace in these kinds of delicate situations.
Yeah, I don't... It's hard for me, because on one hand, I do understand the concerns about police militarization, but... And I understand the concerns about overuse of force. We even see that today. I believe, I forget his first name, but his last name was Garner, was a bigger black man who was basically strangled to death by a police officer for selling cigarettes illegally in New York.
Thanks, Bloomberg, for that.
Right. And that was on film. And
it, you know, we've been told that smoking is a killer for years, so I'm not sure how much blame we should be allocating.
We just didn't know that it meant that a cop would walk into your home somebody and strangle you to death. So I understand the concerns there, and I share them. I think this kind of protest, and believe me, I'm not anti-protest. If you think something is a genuine violation of your rights or completely unjust, then you should absolutely protest. In fact, it's probably your moral duty to protest.
Yeah.
But it's not your moral duty to burn down people's stores or to injure other human beings or to block traffic for tens of thousands of people who are trying to get home to their families or are trying to get to the hospital or are trying to, you know, live their lives. And I think this kind of protest is, this free hugs and then this viral photo, is way more powerful anyway.
And not just protest, but what happened with Natalie Dubose, for example. Her baker, her bake shop was destroyed by the riots, and people started setting up GoFundMe and Kickstarter accounts to help her build her business back. She only asked for about $20,000. She's already close to about $100,000, something like that, last I checked. I mean, people, there's a really great story that can come out of this, which is people's benevolence, you know, uncoerced, unmotivated by altruism, but just because there's a sincere desire to help someone who has had this horrible thing happen to her that she didn't deserve. It's not just that she's hurting, it's that she didn't deserve this. And all of this has happened to her through no fault of her own. The shop owner, there's GoFundMe accounts for the shop owner that got bothered by Mike Brown. And then after the verdict came, after the grand jury decision came out, they rioted and destroyed the man's shop again. So he was victimized by Mike Brown, and then his store was destroyed by people protesting in memory of Mike Brown. And it's funny because I've gotten complaints on my own personal Facebook that, you know, how can you focus on property when when a person's life has ended? And it's one of those things where you really wish you could explain to people how intricately linked your property rights are to your right to life. They're not separate things. I mean, they're together, because, I mean, the right to property is your means of sustaining and enhancing your life. You can't be your best version of yourself. You can't achieve the things you want to achieve if you don't have a right to property. But trying to explain that to some people is just a pain in the butt. But the story to take out of this, my point is, the story to take out of this is that there are is an immense amount of benevolence in this world. People who don't care that Natalie DeBose is black, you know, and they sent her money to help her rebuild. We don't talk about that. We don't think about that. That's not something that the media is interested in. But there really is something positive that can come out of this situation. And we just need to focus on that.
I like it. I like
it. Well said.
I think my overall assessment of the Michael Brown situation is that there's enough fault to go around. Whether or not the grand jury should have indicted Officer Wilson, I wasn't on the grand jury. I haven't seen even a majority of the testimony. It's an unfortunate situation, but everyone in the situation has to take responsibility for their actions. If Mike Brown hadn't decided to rob that store that day, and not just rob that store, but do it in a way where he didn't... If you watch the videotape, this is something that Adam Carolla pointed out that I didn't notice the first time around. It's not as if he took the cigarettes or cigarellos or whatever they were, and when he was about to be caught, dashed out of the store. He came back into the store to harass the owner.
That's right.
That's not the sign of someone who is just a troubled person, you know, trying to steal some cigarettes. And then he's walking down the middle of the street without even the thought that someone might have called the police. It's a terrible situation all around. And if Officer Wilson shouldn't have shot him and killed him, that's, you know, not my determination to make. Maybe he shouldn't have. Point is, everyone needs to check not just their privilege, but their actions and their own code of conduct in that regard.
Their premises.
I am tired already.
Man.
No wonder Justin hosts this show. I can't do this every week. Jesus. Speaking of someone who had to check their conduct, San Francisco 49ers GM apologizes, that's the general manager, after his daughter tweeted something not very nice.
Aww.
I know. Cassie Balk is the college-age daughter of Niners general manager Trent Balk. After San Francisco managed just 167 yards on offense in a 19-3 loss to the Seahawks on Thursday, Cassie tweeted, "Greg Roman can take a hike. The 49ers don't want you no mo."
I love it.
So are we going to point out the grammar on this college-age tweet, or are we just going to let that one slip on by?
She's in college. You know the state of colleges nowadays.
I think if we spent the amount of time on the show that we should pointing out the grammar mistakes of people writing on the internet, the show would be a completely different show. It would be an entirely grammar-based podcast.
Yahoo Amsterdam
did put two. She did put two periods after the take a hike.
Couldn't commit to either a period in a space or an ellipses.
No.
She chose two.
And it's not like the tweet was running out of space. I mean...
Right. You had a few characters left there, sweetheart. Yeah. It reminds me, actually, a friend of mine likes to tell a great story about not giving her... So the story goes, he was managing a play one summer, and he asked a student to get him some trash bags. And the student ran back enthusiastically and said, "I couldn't remember if you wanted one trash bag or three trash bags, so I brought you two trash bags." Which literally gave him 0% chance of being right. Thus, Cassie with the two periods.
So, do we really care? Like, do people care that someone's daughter is tweeting about the team that, like, as the general manager? Like, I mean, this is just, like, this is, if I picked, like, random fan tweets about the 49ers from the game, this one's pretty tame. Like...
Yeah. This one is pretty tame. I think the fact that it came from the general manager's daughter is the reason it's newsworthy. She shouldn't have said it. It's not very nice. Her daddy owns or manages the team, you know. And then the other thing is, we're in this constant age of everything has to be apologized for.
Yeah.
So, of course, Trent Balk had to immediately release a statement. Everyone releases statements nowadays. They don't say things. They release statements.
I'll be releasing a statement right after this podcast is released.
You're going to need to if you want to keep your job. Stamen said, my daughter and I both regret that her feelings got the best of her after last night's game and that she chose social media as an avenue to express her feelings.
How dare she.
We have apologized to Greg for this unfortunate matter. While
disappointed, I thought you were going to say for his unfortunate matter.
For his shitty-ass game. Get it together, Greg. Dot, dot, dot. While disappointed, as a father, I will use this as a teachable moment to help my daughter grow. She's in college.
Ugh.
So he's going to teach her about ellipses.
That's what I
would Let's hope so.
Someone who needs to be taught something is a woman who brought a pig on an airplane. That's right. You heard me correctly, folks. U.S. Airways had to kick a disruptive emotional support pig off a flight recently after the pig decided to use the plane as a pen, pooping all over and squealing uncontrollably.
Oh, God.
This was a 70-pound pot-bellied pig and was brought on the flight as a, quote, emotional support animal for a woman who has anxiety. Did she not think of the anxiety this pig might cause the other passengers? I suppose not.
No, I think, there's a kind of entitled attitude with folks, some folks who have these emotional support animals, and it's very strange. Like, I know in California, you know, it doesn't matter if you're renting an apartment, if you have, or a condo, let's say, and you have rules against pets. All someone has to do is just complain, you know, say it's an emotional support animal, and that sort of just overrides anything that the property owner wants. It's very strange. So I can see why the airline had to at least go through the motions of letting this pig try to fly. But I hope they kicked the passenger off too. It doesn't really say. It only talks about the pig.
Yeah, I don't know. Did they just leave the pig at the airport? Do you check a pig?
I don't know. That 70 pounds is not small. Yeah, I'm trying to think. My dog, Colt, who is trying to interrupt the podcast as much as he can, he's about 70 pounds. Like, that's not a small animal to be taken. Did the pig have its own seat?
No, it was going to sit in her lap. It's an emotional support animal.
70 pounds in your lap? I mean, I travel a lot and I take some carry-on, but that seems a little heavy to me.
Okay, so first of all, 70 pounds of pig, there's only one place for it, and it's roasting on a spit. All right?
Delicious.
Amen.
Delicious. All right, and you broil the skin so that it becomes thick so you can thwack it with a machete like my people do and put it...
Jesus.
But here's the thing. I work at Disney, so we get a lot of what we call guest service animals, which are basically emotional support animals. So, I mean, this probably wouldn't have fazed me, because I have seen rabbits, I have seen snakes, I have seen lizards, the traditional dog and cat, I have seen goldfish, I have seen all kinds of animals used, right? And so it probably wouldn't have fazed me if I had seen it. But, if it's taking a shit, like, in the middle of the aisle, yeah, it's got to go. I've never had a situation where with a pig shitting on a Jungle Cruise boat, you know what I mean?
You know, I'm going to bring my emotional support piranha into work tomorrow and see how that goes.
Where does it end with this? You know what you should be getting emotional support from on an airplane? Booze. An emotional support sherry. Or an emotional support Jack and Coke.
Well, if you didn't have to pay for it, yeah, I'd be getting so much support from
that. Get a doctor's note. They'll give you I think airlines would rather give these emotional support patients unlimited alcohol as opposed to allow these ridiculous emotional support animals on the plane, which only cause anxiety.
I'm trying to concretize this. If there's what did they do to the plane after they kicked the pig off? Because there's pig shit all over, and I grew up on a farm near a pig farm. I wasn't a pig farmer myself, but you know if there ever wasn't a breeze that day for like you know a couple hours, all of a sudden that stench, sort of like a bubble, would just sort of envelop the entire like you know neighborhood, and it's just you just can't get away from it.
Yeah, I
agree. Once you've shit in the aisle, like how do you clean that? You can't have like you're gonna have to rip up the carpet. Like who stayed on that flight? And please tell me it was a flight like from New York to LA, because that would be hilarious.
Ooh, you're mean, William. I like you.
It was from L.A. to Washington, so it was a pretty long flight.
Oh, could you imagine those passengers?
I can't.
Daniel, that could have been you. You could have been on that flight.
It could have been me. Would not have. I don't smell things all that well, so I might have been able to stand it. But, you know, there's some people with some sensitive olfactory senses, so they would have a big problem, I think.
Definitely.
I mean, you can't wear fragrances. You know, I get the fragrance warnings. You know, you can't wear fragrances. We have fragrance-sensitive people. I wonder if that handicap was accommodated for on the flight.
So this is a particular pet peeve of my favorite podcaster in the world, Adam Carolla. See what I did there? Pet peeve. Thank you.
Emotional support peeve.
And he interviewed a flight attendant about this, who told him a story about a dog that actually had projectile diarrhea on a plane once. And they basically do the thing like they used to do in like elementary school, where they put down sawdust on it. And so you then just get the smell of shit and sawdust for 9 hours.
Because I like to add a little bit of pine scent to my to my pig shit. It gives it that extra, you know, just
that floral
quality. Yeah.
And then they typically do just sort of pass out the booze for free so that people don't sue them and whatnot.
Or they take the booze to light it on fire and disinfect the aisle. And we're not mocking all emotional support animals, by the way. I know, like, there are a lot of people like with PTSD who come back from overseas. They have their dogs and their animals that can help them, you know, in their transition. So we're not mocking all of them. But I'm sorry, but you're going to bring a 70-pound pig onto a plane. Like, you better stuff an apple in its mouth, douse it in garlic, and put it in. All right?
No, definitely there are – I think there are a small number of people who benefit from this concept and this therapy. But let's get it together, people. If you need an emotional support animal to get on a flight from L.A. to Washington, maybe you should walk.
There are trains. The pig does much better in a train, I would guess.
I would guess so.
Or drive. Take your damn car.
Exactly.
Go to the truck stop and walk it on a leash, like Suzanne Sugarbaker, you know?
There is no good transition to this next story.
Emotional support gay.
So I'm not going to try. The picture on this story from the Daily Caller is a man holding a rainbow umbrella. So you might suspect that we're about to talk about gay people.
Yay!
Yeah. Good thing we have a gay majority. Gay agenda today on the podcast.
Yes, maybe we're the ones taking over, Daniel. Maybe it's our mutiny.
It's just slowly progressing. So I'm going to sort of introduce the story, and then I'm just going to gingerly toss it over to the gay constituency. Because I
noted
can't
gay
experience
experts.
This, and therefore I have no idea what it's about.
Check your privilege, Daniel.
Exactly. So the story here is a sort of mixture reporting op-ed piece called Nobody is Born That Way, Gay Historians Say, which is a really stupid Dr. Seuss rhymey headline.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Daily Caller. The premise of this article, which is long for a newspaper article, by the way, is that no matter which way you slice it, people aren't born homosexuals, and thus they are not a special class of people deserving of rights in the same way that there are minority rights, basically. So I'm assuming that specifically means no marriage for you guys.
Yeah, so, there's a little bit of confused, like, definitions, some fast and loose definitions in here, and I think that one of them is they've got kind of two ways that they're defining gay. Like, one is gay as in part of a gay culture with a gay identity, and the other is like the actual attraction to men, which is a different thing. Like, it's not like I know there are people who quote unquote participate in gay culture who aren't like who are guys that aren't necessarily attracted to men, right? It is a weird thing to kind of be munging the culture with the sexual attraction piece. In parts of the article, I think they're talking about sexual attraction, and in other parts, I think they're talking about culture, which is, yeah, you're not born with a culture, right? I mean, you're born right into a culture, maybe.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
The basic point is that the idea that we, our culture or Western culture, I guess he's specifically speaking about America, it's a relatively new idea that a person is gay and is only specifically, he thinks of himself in that context. And the culture, the gay culture and gay lifestyle, that these are all relatively new things, and that the previous cultures that have existed on this planet, you know, Greek, the Romans, and all that, they didn't think in terms of gay and straight. That they thought they were, I guess you could, if you wanted to use the term, bisexual, but they viewed homosexual and heterosexual as just the behavior. If you had heterosexual sex or you had homosexual sex, but it wasn't part of one's identity. And I think what he's saying here is that the idea of people being gay as an identity, that's a relatively new thing, as opposed to some sort of adjunct behavioral tick from the ancient world.
Yeah, which I find, I think I tend to agree with William here. It just seems to me, while he explicitly says it's not a semantic thing, it pretty much seems to be a semantic thing.
Yeah.
Like, what exactly are you referring to? He never nails it down.
He never defines what he's saying. Yeah, he never defines what he's saying.
He says at one point, they're saying nobody was gay or straight before about 150 years ago. Well, what the hell? What do you mean by that? There were people who were attracted to women, and there were people who were attracted to men. So what are you referring to in reality? We didn't use the words, okay? Great.
Well, he doesn't. I mean, he likes to vacillate, this guy, between different things, and I think
he does.
You would say he swings both ways.
He swings both ways in every which way. But it's funny because he has a little bit of the Catholic mentality towards homosexuality. It's like you might be gay, but as long as you don't have gay sex, you're okay. The idea of this dichotomy between what you physically are and what you like or what you're attracted to and what you like to pursue, that's kind of what I pick up here. That it's a behavior, not necessarily an identity, so, you know, that you don't have to... he's just kind of all over the place, though.
Yeah. It's also very funny that you say he has a little bit of the Catholic mentality, because he's wildly Jewish.
Oh, I'm sure he is. But I'm just saying, my mentality is Catholic.
Are you judging the picture of David Benkoff? Is that how you say it? Freelance writer for the Daily Caller? Picture?
No, it says he focuses on modern Jewish history and the gay and lesbian past.
Wait, is there a non-gay and lesbian? He just said there's no gay past before 100 years ago. So how would he know?
The other element of this article is the who gives a fuck factor. So, let's accept all of his premises to be true. That if we were like our ancestors and we didn't have gay or straight identifications, what would that do to anything? Would that matter? Would that especially matter in the gay marriage debate? Wouldn't at that point we just especially not care who you marry?
Yeah, and you know we haven't even talked about if this guy's supposed to be in down with history, like there are tons of cultures studied by scientists, anthropologists that have completely different conceptions of sexuality than what we have today. So in a way, he is right that you know the whole Western concept of gay and straight is a relatively new historical precedence, but. You know, there's other cultures with very different like views of masculinity and femininity and what is like sexual pairings and maybe even non-pairings, triplicates and other other things. Yeah, there's and that they'll just even with people. I haven't even talked about the rest of the animal kingdom, right? Like this is not sexuality is very complex and very cultural. But what does this distinction help? He's sort of like arguing that it shouldn't hurt. But then why even bring it up? Like, what is the point?
Well, he's addressing him. I think he's addressing this column to people who believe that whether or not homosexuality is a choice, or whether you're born that way, or whatever. He's writing it in a sense to appeal to the people who believe that a person's morality is tied to that. In other words, the morality of homosexuality is tied to whether or not it's a volitional factor. If there's no volition, if there's no free will in the matter, then they'll explain away, well, okay, maybe it's not a sin, but you still shouldn't have sex with someone of the same sex. But if it is a matter of free will, then it's a behavior and it's sinful and we can condemn it. I think that's probably what the target audience that he has in mind.
And I think I agree with that assessment, except that if that is what he's doing, he still fails wildly.
Oh, yeah.
Almost as wildly as he is Jewish.
Oh man, you should see this picture.
He's basically holding a pound of flesh. That's how Jewish he is. If he's alluding to that, if it's not innate, if you're not born with it, then the opposite is true, right? Then it has to be some kind of choice. But isn't that a false dichotomy?
Yeah.
Couldn't it be not innate and not a choice? Couldn't it be basically, if it's not a social construct, because do you even know how much I fucking hate that term? Social construct. But it could be a psychological construct from childhood. And not to mention, and then I'll let you respond to my rant, what about heterosexuality? Where does that come from then? And why aren't we talking about that as also a choice or a social construct? Homosexuality
was only made 200 years ago or so when Adam and Eve met. And then that's when we invented heterosexuality.
Thank you, Ken Ham.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny because he mentions, like, oh, they have not found the gay gene. But genetics is just one avenue. There's a whole plethora of stuff that we have not studied about human sexuality within our bodies, within psychology, within a lot of fields. So I'm not, with the fact that we witness homosexuality in the animal kingdom with dogs and other animals, I mean, obviously they don't necessarily have the volitional capacity that human beings have. So right away that should tell you that choice is not the dominating factor here.
Yeah. There's so much wrong with this article that I think it would require a dissertation to really address it all. I just don't, ultimately, the sort of theme we're working with this week is code of conduct. So let me pose this to you. If we take his ultimate premise as true, that no one is born gay, would that change the way either of you act?
I could not see myself being any other way. So it's sort of like, could I see myself, you know, being a different gender or being, you know, 12 feet tall? Or it's such, in part way, it's such a part of who I am. And in another way, like, I've never been a huge participant in, quote unquote, the gay culture. So I'm, you know, in a way, the culture part, I could care less about, right? Like, I don't watch Project Runway. I don't watch, you know, all those crazy, you know, I don't watch Glee. I don't watch any of this stuff that's the stereotype, right? I just don't do that
stuff.
You're
a terrible gay.
I'm a terrible gay. I suck at fashion. it's awful because my boyfriend's the same way. We can't dress each other. So it's like we're stuck asking some random girl if we match. So in a way, I guess I don't think it would change my behavior, whether or not it was a choice or I was born that way. I wouldn't want to change it.
Hmm. Elliot, would you change?
No, just no.
Good.
I mean, what would be the impetus to change?
You know, the classic X-Men story, right? You know,
yeah.
Do you want to give up your superpower? I think I'll hold on to mine. Thanks.
Well, I just don't see the point. Like, what would be the point of changing? Like, oh, would you change how you act? Like, well, no. I mean, it doesn't take anything away from my life, first of all. And secondly, there's just no, I don't respond to women the way that I do to men. And I mean, I'm not going to make myself unhappy pretending otherwise to please anybody else, or, you know, just it wouldn't make a difference to me.
To please so a Daniel, Jewish historian.
Daniel, let me turn the question to you. Would it change the way you acted towards the homosexuals?
No, not at all. And it's because the inverse would be true, right? And it's the question I ask every straight person I meet who thinks that homosexuality is a choice, which is, when did you choose to like pussy?
You ask that to every straight person? Because I think 50% of them would be confused.
Yes, everyone I meet. No, every straight person who believes that homosexuality is some kind of choice. And I just, like, I don't remember when I chose. I guess, according to your logic, I did, though. When did you choose? Was it, like, your 13th birthday? Or, you know, did your mom give you a flowchart? Like, how did it work? And you're like,
it's like going to the eye doctor. They go, A or B?
It's like, cock, vagina. I'm going to go with vagina. I just don't understand. And it certainly wouldn't change the way I think about you guys. I love you guys.
Aww. So, we love you too.
Thank you. All right.
Enough gay.
Manly things. So Elliot wasn't born gay, William wasn't born a rocket surgeon, and I certainly wasn't born a Mexican. But Justin was born to jibber jabber. Hear his review of The Walking Dead mid-season finale next in TV with JML.
Thanks, Daniel. It's really great being here on my own show. You're doing a admirable job. Anyway, it's hard to believe, but we're already halfway through the fifth season of The Walking Dead, and there's only one thing that can be said, at least according to the internet. R.I.P. Beth. But, of course, I want to talk about something a little bit different. I want to focus on theme. And the great thing about this episode was, as we've been sort of harping on the season, or as I have been harping on, the way this episode was written. As an individual episode, this was great. Theme and choice were integrated very well. We saw Beth, we saw Dawn, we saw Rick, and the other characters all struggle with what it would take to survive and what needed to be done. We saw it with Rick in the opening scene where he killed Bob too, white Bob. No, I don't think he was white, but he killed the second Bob and he said shut up when he did it. And Rick has sort of become this very harsh person in response to the governor and the hunters and now Dawn's group at the hospital. Whereas Dawn over the episode seemed to be having more of a crisis. In a way, she seemed softer and nicer than Rick. She was more sympathetic towards Beth. And of course, the whole episode and this whole half of the season has been Beth's journey to become like the other survivors. Ultimately, that killed her, which I think is a statement by the show, and I'll return to that in a second. But the important thing to remember here is this is also contrasted with the way Gareth was over the beginning of the season. So again, talking about how The Walking Dead has been writing some killer episodes since Gimple took over, no pun intended, it still suffers from repeating the same overall themes. Rick, Dawn, Gareth, the governor. These are all the same sort of variations on the same character type, the same, I guess you could call it an overall theme, but it's a very negative view of humanity. And in that sense, this is my biggest critique of this episode. Where is the show going to go from here? So you can sit here and you can argue that, you know, the reason all these characters are the same is because it's the theme they're playing with. What does it take to survive? How bad of a person are you willing to become to survive? And ultimately, that creates a very negative world that The Walking Dead lives in. But if you look at that, it also makes the story very stagnant. And that's something that I've been very critical of during Gipple's run as showrunner. There's been nowhere for this to go. When you eliminate the Eugene lie, where is this show going to go forward from here? When you've already gone to the hospital and tried to rescue Beth, where is the show going to go forward from here? Likewise, if you look at what actually happened in this season, the way it's paced, what happened at the mid-season, you could argue this mid-season finale has exactly the same point thematically and exactly the same ending thematically as season 2, the most hated season. Why? The first half of season 2 was all about, where is Sophia? Sophia represented hope. And when Rick opened up that barn and he saw her and he shot her, that was symbolic of hope dying in the Walking Dead universe. Well, again, we have a young, innocent girl who Daryl had taken under his wing. She was captured by evil people, and they were trying to rescue her. And what happened? They ultimately were unable to rescue her. There is a futility in this universe that's been established, and there's no getting around it. There's no overcoming it. That futility will always come back. That's one of the biggest things the comic suffers from, and it's apparent in the show as well. And in that sense, since there's nowhere for this to go, someone will always die, this futility will always come back, and now that there's no conflict propelling this story forward beyond the conflict that's always going to exist as how do we survive, what is it going to take to survive, this episode could have been a series finale. The way it was shot, the way it was written, I would be satisfied if they said, show's over, nothing else happening. But I know it will continue because I read the comics, it's such a moneymaker, and they're doing a spinoff. I just wish at some point they would step back and introduce an overarching conflict beyond how bad of a person do we have to become to survive. Because ultimately, that is a really negative statement on the human condition.
Thanks, Justin. That was both insightful and inspiring. I am truly moved, much like enchiladas through a colon. But now it's time to hear from our own cadre of Walking Dead in Yahoo Answers Answers. First question. What does a code of conduct mean, and how does it work each day?
Each day.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So some days might not work. Some days it just doesn't work. Is that what he's saying? How does it work each day? Does it work differently one day to the next?
Maybe.
This is taking me back to like high school when we used to, like, first day of class would be like, we're going to do this exercise. My job, your job. Here's our code of conduct. We're going to decide what our code of conduct is for this class. And it's going to be different for each class. So, good luck.
So what does it mean for you guys, though? Do you think about it? Do you think about morality? And that's why I'm going to sort of push us in that direction. Do you think of morality on a day-to-day basis as a code of conduct? Or is there a vast difference between something that is a code of conduct and something that is a morality?
You go first, William.
Well, I was going to say, I think a code of conduct seems like a very, very rigid and almost like prescriptive, like, do and don't list, right? Like, this is the code of conduct. You're going to do X, Y, and Z, and Y and is going to be the consequence if you don't. And, you know, morality is really a set of principles, right? It's understanding how to apply those principles to the unique situations you see. So it's not, there's not a prescriptive, like, step-by-step code.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Is a code of conduct better than nothing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it can be better than nothing. I think sometimes, you know, at least with kids, you know, it's easier to understand sometimes a code of conduct. But if you're not connecting that back to the principles that are involved, and there's really no learning taking place, you're just parroting what other people are doing, and it can end up leading you in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think code of conduct is good for behavior. If you're talking about specific behaviors, if you're going to school, this is the code of conduct you need to follow in the classroom so that we can all learn and so that the classroom can run smoothly. If you work for a company like mine, you know, like Disney, where they give you a certain code of conduct, even though they don't necessarily call it that, but there's certain ways that they expect cast members to behave to preserve the magic, you know, for the guests and for the little kids. But I think a code of conduct speaks specifically to behaviors, not necessarily to a rational understanding of what is in your rational self-interest. I think that morality deals with that a little bit more specifically. It's a little bit more long-term concepts that are going to hold you in good stead, no matter what comes your way, like much like what William said. And I think a code of conduct is very specific towards the people who you're dealing with and perhaps the situation, like the employment or the education that you're going to receive.
So let me flip the script a little here and massage the question, because it's my show this week, damn it. Do what I want.
And you are a benevolent dictator.
Indeed, I am. Thank you, Commissar. And let me ask, is there a political relationship with code of conduct versus morality? And now it's going to be a little bit of a stretch here, and so I'll expect you to tell me that. But I feel like with the left especially, they're almost aprincipled, meaning they don't want us to have principles which we could apply to given situations. They want a really, really prescriptive code of conduct. Don't do this, don't say this, check this, don't differ, perpetrate, etc., etc., etc. Is that generally correct? Because that's what I feel like all the time with at least the social justice nonsense.
I kind of agree with that, because I think when the left really likes the idea of, they have this view of man as just being no different than any other animal. So they think if we can just get people to stop doing this and stop doing that, then other generations, they'll just intuitively not do these things. And it doesn't matter what the underlying principles are. It doesn't matter what ties to reality that, you know, our demands have. Peace will be achieved if we can rob people of the deeper understandings of what we're asking them to do, and if they will just behave in one way as opposed to another. It's the attempt to change the behavior without dealing with the underlying moral principles that underlie the choices.
I think sometimes you have the rules are too strong and they're inflexible, so we can't have this principle, but we can have this sort of checklist of behaviors. You know, we can't have this principle that can apply everywhere because that's just, you know, too constraining, and you know, we have to deal with the spur of the moment changes and things can change. So we'll just make up rules as we go along. We'll make up codes of conduct as we go along and then just constantly change them as conditions change.
Yeah. And now I from our readers who write often and call me a right-wing Republican Sarah Palin fucking nut job, I'm not saying then that the political right is the principled side of this argument. I think they have their own problems. I think they tend to lean more pragmatism, which they see as a form of principle, but it's not. I just think it's a false dichotomy is really what I was getting at ultimately. But then again, that's me. Any final thoughts for this young person on the internet? How does it work each day? Well, a code of conduct, I don't think, does work each day. I think it's necessarily going to fail. Only when you look at things from a principled manner will you get a morality that works on a day-to-day basis. Question number two. Guys, what is the guy code? And he goes on to elaborate. Guys always talk about the guy code. What is it? Thank you. That's a great elaboration. And then he goes on in a parenthetical to say, sorry, I'm bored. I'm being forced to watch Sex and the City, and if I don't distract myself, I'll have to kill myself.
Okay, first of all, being forced to watch Sex and the City, there is no such thing.
Oh,
okay, I'm picturing some sort of like Clockwork Orange mechanism to keep this person, keep this person watching Sex and the City.
Harry Bradshaw technique. No more horse face, please.
Horse face.
So I think the guy code is really ambiguous. I think there are multiple guy codes, the most famous in recent history being the Barney Stinson, like, bro code,
yeah,
or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it's basically this concept of, if you're going to be a man, this is the way that men act. And it is basically a checklist. It is very much a code of conduct.
It's usually quite misogynistic, right? I mean,
yeah.
Barney certainly is. The bro code certainly is.
Yeah, usually. I don't think it's necessary. Like, I think I've seen some that aren't misogynistic. The artofmanliness.com, for instance, is actually a pretty helpful website.
They helped me write a bachelor speech. They had great guidelines on how to write a best man speech. So.
Yeah. I think they do the best. If you want to believe in something called a guy code, probably Art of Manliness is your best bet. And I also have a book called The Man Code, I think, which actually the most interesting chapter in it is there is an algorithmic setup for where you should stand at a urinal. And they have like this incredibly long mathematical equation, so you can figure out in every single scenario the optimal place to stand in a men's bathroom. I thought that was pretty interesting. Other than that, I got nothing because I don't follow a guy code.
Yeah, me neither.
I follow a human code.
I wish guys came with some sort of manual. Is that the same thing? Because then you'd know exactly what code of conduct to do.
Oh, yes. I share that with you as well.
Okay, we're going to move on before I...
Before I gaze up again?
Before we start group hugging and then it turns into an orgy.
Start passing the split.
Next question. What does go along to get along mean?
Ugh.
And he clarifies, we have to write these reflections about the quote, you have to go along to get along. What does it mean?
It means sacrifice your individuality so that people will like you.
It means give in to peer pressure, conform. Just go with the flow and smooth along and, you know, like lemmings, go jump off the cliff.
That's right. Follow the crowd right over the edge.
It means make other people like you. So
don't
that way you
yourself.
Can have a herd to hang out with. Yeah, I think we could pretty much got it there.
Yeah.
Next don't question. Money destroys morality? Isn't it true that money destroys morality?
Wow, he elaborated so well.
Yes, that's true. That's exactly what happens.
All right, well, okay. Obviously, the three of us sitting here, like, having this conversation, like, we obviously have a different view of money and morality. I don't want to speak for the two of you, but, I mean, I'll say my view of money is that it's the ultimate expression of morality because it's an expression of the trader principle, which is the idea that that nobody owes you anything and you don't owe anybody else anything. You create value, the other person creates value, and you exchange, and money is the means of that exchange taking place. So I do not believe that money destroys morality. I think money detached from its basic understanding, money that's stolen or money that's wielded through some inappropriate means, I mean, I think money can be used in an immoral fashion, but I don't think that money itself destroys morality.
Yeah,
but if there was no money, wouldn't we just all be nice to each other and give each other what we need?
We'd all be dead.
We would all be gay hugging, and then we would die. Now, you know, I'm just reminded, if I'm sure there's a few folks who haven't read Alice Shrugged yet, but that listen to the podcast, read Francisco's money speech, and he talks exactly about this in the book, in his speech. And you can read the speech without getting any spoilers if you haven't read Alice Shrugged. And he talks about how money will certainly destroy an immoral man, but it's also for a moral man, for someone who's earned it, it is an ultimate multiplier of what they're able to do. It's an extension of their life. It represents what they are owed and what they can do.
Money is a tool like any other tool, and it will help you or it will hurt you depending on your use of it, and your use of it is what can be moral or immoral, and that basically means you can be moral or immoral.
But if you do feel like money's going to destroy your morality, please send it to my house.
The Midside at...
We will set up a PayPal account called we'll the Money is Immoral PayPal account.
Yep. We will take your immoral money and turn it into moral action.
Oh yeah, we will.
Probably
strippers, bitches! Make it rain. So, last question. Sort of along the lines of code of conduct, but a little bit of shift in tone here. Do you think there is such thing as eye rape?
Back to Clockwork Orange.
Ow!
EYERAPE, eye rape. Clarification. Should there be laws to protect women from creepy guys eye raping them?
If you mean inserting their cocks into an eye socket, then yes.
I think Bob Saget properly named that skull rape, not rape.
Depending on the size.
I think Full Metal Jacket didn't the wasn't there a line about skull fucking in that too? So yeah. by the drill sergeant.
Yeah, absolutely.
That movie.
I think there already is laws in the book for that kind of literal raping of the eye. But if you mean just staring at someone, I don't think there should be a law against staring at someone.
If you're creepy, William?
Well, if I'm creepy, then you should just go somewhere else. Like,
Shouldn't women have the right to feel, you know, uncomfortable?
You don't have a right to not be offended or to not be comfortable. I mean, if someone's like stinky or something, I guess you could kind of claim they're violating your rights to some extent, depending on how stinky they are. But I don't see how looking at someone just, you know, from a distance. I mean, if you're getting in someone's face and like staring at them and like, I don't know, sticking your tongue in their eye or something like that. I mean, we're getting into assault, right? When you start doing that stuff, but I don't think you can eye rape by looking at someone.
Rape by looking or rape by mere intention without actually acting on it. Yeah, I don't think so. If that were the case, then I've raped Chris Evans so many times. But
did you eye rape him or regular rape him? I'm confused.
Ouch, that would hurt.
I think this is a political offshoot of the concept of the male gaze. And how men objectify women merely by looking at them.
That's G-A-Z-E or G-A-Y-S? What are we talking about here? Male gaze?
Male gaze. I'm like, well, wait.
Yeah, so, no, you can't be raped by someone staring at you. Stop using words that aren't metaphorical as metaphors.
Daniel, you are perpetuating the rape culture right now.
I know. I can never know what a woman goes through when she is eye-fucked by some guy.
You've never experienced eye-fucking. Therefore,
I guess not.
Is that from Apple, eye-fucking? Is that like a dildo that like you can surf the net on?
Yeah, it's called iOS 8.
Nice.
But do you know who truly had their eyes raped? Anyone who saw the recently leaked screener of Annie. It's a hard knock life for Sony Studios in the non-crisis of the week. You may have seen on the news, the real news, not the podcast news, that at least 5 movies from Sony Pictures have been devoured on copyright-infringing file-sharing hubs online in the wake of a hack attack that hobbled the studio earlier this week, Variety reports. Copies of DVD screeners of 4 unreleased Sony movies, including Annie and Fury, have been downloaded hundreds of thousands of times, causing Sony Studios to freak the fuck out. Thoughts, gentlemen? Certainly this is a crime. It is theft. I am not one of those anti-IP morons. I think whoever did this should be punished. But do you think this is ultimately going to hurt Sony?
I think it could. I think there's a lot of a lot more data than just the movies that were released. Pastebin is full of salary information and other proprietary information that's internal to the company. So this is a lot of their, I mean, they are in the movie and music and, you know, business, right? They're in this business, and there's a lot of things about how they do things that is out there now that could, you know, give folks a sort of unfair advantage, or give them the fruits of Sony's labor without paying them for it.
Yeah, I definitely think that element of it is very important. But let's just take the context of the films. Do you think the fact that the films, and according to a recent update, Fury has been downloaded more than 1.2 million times, do you think that is going to hurt them? Just the pure downloading of the movies. Because, and my question is, not that it is right, not that it is moral, not that it is a good thing, but doesn't this basically happen all day, every day anyway?
Yeah, there's a lot of illegal downloads. That's true. I guess the type of person who's going to download these movies illegally, for the most part, are not going to also be the type of person to go to the movie theater. But I don't know. I guess if it's a good movie, there could be some mixed effect, right? It could be, you know, get sort of good reviews, and then people will go see it. But it makes you wonder. I mean, I don't know how close some of these were to release. So, you know, this might not even be this may not be their final form, right? There might be other changes to be made before these things go out.
Yeah, certainly. So Fury is already in theaters. I think Annie premieres next week or something like that, which, if you were going to see Annie anyway, just stop. I don't know what you're doing. First of all, if you're listening to this podcast, stop. We don't need you. Just get it. We love everyone.
Our three listeners.
But my second point was something I don't even remember. So I think part of what could be hurtful about this, which isn't, at least wasn't talked about in this article specifically, is who did this hacking, and is it possible that it could happen more? So, originally, this was attributed to North Korea, and I'm not even making that up. That wasn't an Onion article. And it's sort of in retaliation for the upcoming Sony movie, The Interview, which features a fake assassination of Kim Jong-un. But now I think they're saying it's an internal Sony employee, and I think that's dangerous. Genuinely dangerous for them.
Here's the thing. We didn't, and I know that this is kind of off subject, but I hope you'll bear with me. We did not need a remake of Annie. I cannot believe that the geniuses, the brain trust at Sony Pictures, freaking had to remake Annie. Nobody is going to top Carol Burnett or Albert Finney. It's just not going to happen. I adore Cameron Diaz, but no.
We needed a social justice Annie.
Ugh. That was me throwing up.
Now, was Annie born straight?
Gingers. Not born.
Not anymore. Not in anything. The remake. She's not Ginger anymore.
She's not?
No. Oh. She's black. It's like an inner city...
Can't have a black Ginger? What kind of racism is that?
They don't have a black Ginger.
That's it. I'm calling bullshit on all of this. Sony, you're going to be fine. Catch the person. Put him in prison. You're going to be fine.
Yeah, you know, this gets back... You know, if Sony had all this trouble with the PlayStation Network getting hacked years back, and There's something wrong, you know, not to get all computer nerdy on you, something wrong with the security at, you know, the way they're doing their computer security at Sony. And if you're an investor in Sony, I would caution you.
And okay, here's the thing, and the last thing I want to say about this, but you are a security expert, so we're going to exploit that as much as we can. The early reports on this are not so much that Sony was quote-unquote hacked, which we use that word so much that it has no more meaning, but basically that Sony employees had terrible passwords on, like, their email accounts and such, and that's how the people got a lot of this stuff.
Their birthdays, things like that.
There's no general security anyway. So when I was working with Frack Nation, one of the things we scooped was we published the script of Promised Land, which was the anti-fracking film by Matt Damon. Now, we sort of thought, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe it's illegal. And then we realized, do you know how we found that script? We didn't have to guess Matt Damon's email address. We had to type into Google, Promised Land script PDF. And it came up on their website.
Wow. As
something that was just stored there, perhaps to share with people. But that was completely public and open and downloadable.
Wow. Excuse me while I type in Avengers Age of Ultron script PDF. I'm just kidding, I won't do that.
And so I think this is a general cultural thing that needs to shift. People need to realize this is the digital era, goddammit. Secure your shit.
Yeah, and security is not easy. Passwords are a terrible way to secure things, but that's just sort of what we have right now. And
so we can use our own blood. When we can draw blood, you know, through the computer and have it stored, recognized by our DNA.
Yeah, absolutely.
But until then, you know, don't pick your birthday or your pet's name or, you know, there's better ways to pick passwords.
Sony 12345.
Yeah, that's the best password you can come up with at Sony. That's a problem. First, if your system allows you to put that in as your password, then you need to talk to your security guys and find out why they haven't implemented something else.
Yeah. By the way, not going to lie, most of my passwords are Atlas Shrugged references. Just
I know whose email I'm hacking.
Yeah, exactly.
They haven't read it, so, you know.
Francisco is hot, 69. So, gentlemen, what did we learn this week? Elliot?
Well, I learned that if I'm white, then I need to understand what black people go through, except it's impossible for me to understand what black people go through. So I should want to understand it, but it's impossible for me to understand it.
Hmm. Wise words. William?
I learned that guys do not have a guy code that you can look at and disassemble and understand what they're thinking. And it's really crushed me. I wish there was a guy code that I could just use to decipher all guys.
That you could hack and like change the CSS?
Hack and change? Yeah, oh man. If I could hack some guy code, man.
That sounds so rapey.
I rapey, actually.
Yeah.
Ouch.
And I learned that my emotional support Clydesdale will no longer be allowed on most U.S. Airways flights.
Ooh.
That makes me very upset.
It's very sad. It's a sad day in America.
Absolutely. If you learned something, you should tell us by giving us a 5-star review. Not 4, not 3, not 2, not 1, but 5-star review on iTunes. It helps us get the show to more and more people. And it helps us grow the podcast network. We need some money, people. The only way to get that is to get Coca-Cola to sponsor our really, really racist show. So, till next time, I'm Daniel T. Richards, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the midside. Good luck, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
So here we are. Now I'm recording. William, are you recording on your end as well?
Let me double check this. Hold on. It likes to hide itself behind a window. Yes, I'm recording currently.
And the NSA is recording as well, I'm sure, so we've got it covered.